neglected to realize that Alessandro Cassin from the Primo Levi Center is here with us, who was deeply involved in helping to put the film together. So we're honored to have you with you, and thank you for all your efforts. We're especially honored to have also with us Stella Levy, who is a Holocaust survivor herself. Stella came to speak for us in Brooklyn many years ago, and I still remember your talk, and every once in a while I think of you. And to see you here all of a sudden, unexpected, is really, really such a pleasure. And so wonderful for to be here, and we're very honored for you to... Do you want to say anything? Okay. All right. Next year we'll have to organize something more official. Both. Okay. One of the most impactful books I've ever read was Kafka's The Trial. I actually read it after my first date with my wife. That didn't sound quite right. We kind of just became friends, and she gave me this the trial to read because I was going away to study in Israel for a year, and she said, "Here, take this with you." Kafka writes that he wanted all of his books to be like a pickaxe on your brain, and it was just exactly that for me. Martin Buber has said that Kafka's The Trial was the most important commentary written on the book of Job ever, because what happens to Joseph K. is a story of certainly inspired by Eov. We'll just read the first line. "Someone must have been telling lies about Joseph K. He knew he had done nothing wrong, but one morning, he was arrested." And so on. Kafka wrote this in 1915, 1916, and it's just amazing watching this movie, for those who weren't here, of the Jews in Rome living a normal life, part of society, good citizens, all of a sudden one day, not having done anything wrong, all of a sudden are arrested and rounded up. So with that in mind, the trial ends pretty grim. I won't give it away in case you haven't read it yet. Okay, it's only been out 100 and so years, but okay. What I'd like to do today is focus on God's answer to Eov. Right? After all, we all want to know the answer. Okay, we know the story. We got some of the discussion in the middle, but what is the answer? And generally, when people refer to Eov, says, "Yeah, we know the answer." The answer is, we can't know anything, right? Eov, where were you when the world was created? What do you know? You're a puny human being, right? And so the answer is left open-ended. And that's partly true. I think if the answer in the end was, 24, then, right, what is that? That machine, big machine, right? They ask it all, put all everything in the universe, and that's the answer it gives. Right? If it gave some kind of pat answer, then it wouldn't be a classic, because it's a complex, human, ever-present question. However, having said that, I think that the conclusion does tell us more than just, we can't know anything, because you could have just said that, at the outset, and you wouldn't have to have all the conversations, and especially the conversations at the end, and what God actually says in his speech to Eov. I think it's more than just, you weren't there, you're not as great as me. I think there's actually some content that we can learn from. And so what I'd like to do is read some of these verses and sections, and then look at a few modern thinkers and how they have reacted and applied the lesson of Eov, especially in post-Holocaust theology. Okay, so I'm going to get to chapter 38, which is God's response from the whirlwind. But before we do that, I have to look at an intertext first, because God is, I think, actually responding word for word almost to Eov what Yov says in chapter 3, and this is insights that were written about by Robert Alter. You could read more there. And so, just quickly, right? Yov was the object of a bet between God and Satan, kind of like Trading Places, right? So the movie. No. If you haven't seen that, you have a lot of homework to do. Okay, and the question is Yov really righteous, or is he only righteous because God gives him health and wealth and children and everything? And so, B'nai Elohim are all there. It's the weekly meeting with God and all of his angels. And so Satan brings up this point. Actually, God brings up this point. Did you see anybody as great as Iyov? And he gives permission to Satan. And now Iyov has lost everything, all of his wealth, his children, his health. He's deeply suffering. His wife said, just bless God, meaning curse God, and die. And he says, no, God gave us good. And we are we not going to bless God for the good as for the bad? And so he sticks with his faith. His three friends come to comfort him. They don't speak for 7 days and seven nights. And finally, in this chapter, we begin with Iyov's first words that he speaks. And you say, Acharechen patach Iyov et piyo vaykalel et yomo vayan Iyov vayomar. Yov ad yom yivaled bo. So if you are in tune with the Hebrew, you can hear the alliteration. Let that day perish when I was born, and the night when it was announced that a man has been brought forth. So as typical in Hebrew poetry, there's a parallelism between part A and part B that balance each other out. And so the continuation of the poem is going to stretch this theme of day and night. It says, that day, Hayom Ahu, Yehi Choshech, Al Yidishu Elo Mimal, Ve'al Tofa Alav Nehara. That day should become night. And God should not inquire about it. After all, God was inquiring before about what's going on. And there should be no light shining on it. Yigaluhu Choshech V'Salmavet. Tishkon alav anana yebatuhu kimride yom. Let darkness and shadow claim it for their own. Yigaluhu usually is a positive word. Ligol, right, is to redeem. Let it be redeemed, taken over by darkness and sel salmavet, deep darkness, sel shadow of death. And let a cloud dwell over it, a dark cloud. Remember this. This cloud is going to come up again. Make it black. Halayla hu yikachehu ofel al yichad bimeshana b'mispar yirachim al yavo. That night, it should be taken. No, there should be no rejoicing on that day. I'm sorry, I skipped. Yeah. Hine halayla hu yigalmud al tavo renana. Right. That day should not be counted among in the calendar, right? Strike it from the calendar. I wish it never existed. And if it never existed that way, I never would have been born. This actually happened. One of the popes in the 1400s wanted to change from the Gregorian calendar to the from Julian to Gregorian, Pope Gregory. And so he had to skip 11 days in October. Right, I think it was all October 4th, and he skipped to October 15th, and there were riots in the streets because people said, now you're shortening our days by 11 days, because if I'm destined to die on June 20th, and now I'm 11 days closer, right? Okay. But Iyov is saying, I wish that day never existed, and so that I wouldn't have to be born on it. There shouldn't have been any joy coming on that day, the joy that people came together and celebrated when he was born. It's a beautiful play on words, that day should be cursed by those who curse the day. But the Hebrew word for those who curse is orere, which is the same word as or, meaning light. And so the poet here takes the word or and transforms it into curse. So or, that curse the light. curse the day that brings light. Those who arouse Leviathan, you don't want to just get the regular curses. You need the deluxe version. Those who, when Leviathan comes, they know how to handle that too. Yechshechu kochevei nishpo yekav leor va'ayin ve'al yireh ba'af apeh shachar. He wants all the stars to be black. So now he's turning, he talked about the day, and the day should be night, and even the night should have no glimmer of hope, right? All the stars, the twilight, let the night look for light, but have none. Let it not behold the eyelids of the morning. So he wants it to be, that day to be gone, to be turned into darkness, and forevermore, everything should be dark. Why? He finally says, "Ki lo sagar dalte bitni vayaster amal me'enai," because God should have shut the doors of my mother's womb, and there and then hid trouble from my eyes. And because He didn't do that, He wishes it had. Why didn't I die in the womb, and so on? Okay, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you can skip down because these words are going to come up. Look at verse 21. Those who are in such suffering that they long for death, but it comes not, and they dig for it more than for hidden treasures. And what a wonderful image, because you think of someone digging for treasure, but he's digging, looking for, because he wants his grave. His grave is more is greater for him than finding a treasure. Hasimechim elegil yasisu kim su kaber legeber asher didarkonistara vayasech eloa ba'ado. Who rejoices in exultation and are glad when they find the grave? To a man whose way is hid and whom God has hedged in. So here at the end of this speech, you have the word geber again. The day we started with, the day Geved was announced that he was born, and now a man, right, whose way is hidden. And vayasech is an important word. Vayasech means hedged in. Says God, you have blocked my way. I feel like I'm stuck in a maze and can't get out. It's an interesting word, because all the way in the opening chapter, when Satan comes to God and says, "What does he? Is he righteous for no reason? You have sachta, ta sachta ba'ado. You have protected him all around from bad," right? And so we have the same image of something surrounding someone can be seen as protection, as by Satan. But Iyov says, "Now you have hedged me in, all about." Okay, so this is Iyov's opening words. So he's very dark and deep and gloomy, and understandably so. And it goes on, and as the friends come, and the friends say, "You know, what are you getting so riled up about? You deserve what's coming to you. Why do you think God is just? And so therefore you must have done some terrible sin for this all to happen to you." And that only makes Iyov more upset. And Iyov's rhetoric becomes greater and greater, and he says, I would bring God to justice. But who would be the judge, right? If I made a suit, God would just bully me, and I wouldn't be able to get a word in edgewise. I wouldn't be able to get a fair trial, certainly. Okay, then we're going to fast forward, because that discussion goes on for a few rounds. And then finally, Vayan Adonai Diyov min ha-se'ara v'yomar. God answers Job out of a whirlwind. It's an appropriate metaphor, right? Because Iyov is now surrounded by these arguments. He must have been quite a dizzying and overpowering experience. And God says, "Mize machshich etza b'milin b'lidat." On page 2, verse 2, chapter 38. Who is it that darkens counsel with these words that have without knowledge? And this is perfect, because Iyov said, "I want the day to all become night." Right? He was advocating darkness, and God says, who's saying these dark things? Ezor na ke geber chalasecha, eshalecha vehodieni. Gird your loins like a man, geber. Remember, we already had. Iyov says, right? I wish I was never a geber. I wish they never announced it. Right? I am a gevet, I am a man who whose ways are enclosed. And now he says, you know, let's see your bravery, and let's see if you can answer a few questions that I have for you. You asked a lot of questions. Now it's my turn, God is saying. Efo hayita beyosdi adetz. Hagedim yadata bina. Where were you when I made the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have some understanding. Mi same madeha ki teda o mina ta aleha kav. Who determined the measurements of each section of the world, or where it's going to be, or made the kav, made the plumb line, right, to make it straight? Kav is another word that actually came before already. Yekav, before we had yekav le'od, they hope for light in verse 9 on the first page. And so here it's the same, different meaning, but it still might be a play on words. Al ma adaneh hotba'o mi yara even pinata. Right? Whereupon was the foundations fastened? Who laid the cornerstone? So the foundations under the earth, going all the way from the deepest bottom to the top, the cornerstone that is at the top of an arch. Beron yachad koch beboker bayariu kol bene Elohim. Where were you when the morning stars, once creation comes together, when the morning stars sang? And all the sons of God shouted for joy. And you can see here that this is a direct response to Iyov's words, right? First of all the stars, the very stars that God, that Iyov says, I wish there were no stars at night, right? And he says, look, think of all the stars rejoicing, and you can go out at night, and even though it's dark, but you see these twinkling in the sky, and this is, there's joy. So I think there's more than just the dark and night, but this is representing that hope, that possibility that is there even in dark times. When all B'nai Elohim were shouting for joy, these very same B'nai Elohim that we met all the way back in the first chapter, God's Divine Counsel. Vayasech bidlatayim yam begicho merechem yaseh. What a beautiful pasuk. Were you there when I shut the sea with doors, when it broke forth and issued out of the womb? Okay, first we have to understand a little bit how ancient cosmogony, if you remember it back in Genesis 1, right, there was chaos, water, there was waters all over covering the earth, everything, and God had to separate the waters above, put in its place, separate the waters into the ocean, and put it there in order to have land. And you think, okay, good, God did a good job, he created it, and now it's all good, right? Hine tov me'od. But you see in a lot of pesukim, tell you, you go to the beach, and then you see that the ocean keeps trying to come back in and take over the land, and then God has to come and push it out, right? And it comes back in, you have to keep pushing it out. There's a constant tension between the two, right? And so it's also a birthing imagery, as you'll see it come up. And so God says, where were you when I shut the doors of the sea to make sure it would not come back again and destroy the land? I mean, it does once in a time of the flood and other floods that happen, right? That's when kind of the forces of creation are undone. So that's the imagery. The word that he used, the first word, Vayasech bidlatayim yam, who shut the doors up, who protected him. That's the same word we had before, already twice, right? The same word that Satan says, Sachta ba'ado, God, you have protected him all around, and Yoh feels like, I'm not being protected, I'm being enclosed, and here God is saying, I need to enclose that evil, right? Those forces of chaos in order for you to exist. I think a lot of times, we make a lot of rules for our kids. I just downloaded an app that limits their screen time. So I have total control when they can use it and when they can't use it, right? So they feel like I'm being controlled and I feel like I'm protecting you. Okay, so it's all in the, it's all a matter of perspective here, right? But God is saying, right, I'm making these boundaries, it's true, but these are for your protection. Besumi anan levusho barafel chatulato. God says, I made the clouds as a garment for the earth, and the thick darkness a swaddling cloth. This is another really beautiful image, because you go out and see a cloudy day, and one person says, oh, it's cloudy, dreary, dark, depressing. And that's what Yov says, right? That they be cloudy. Gus says, clouds? When you see a cloud, right, you think of a little baby, and you put a blanket around it to keep it warm, to swaddle it, to give it a protection and a sense of comfort. And so that's what I'm doing here with the clouds. It's fantastic. And so on. So let's go forth a little. 12, he says, Hamiyamecha sivita boker, yadata shachar mekomo. Did you ever command daytime to come up, right? You say you don't want daytime to come up. You were ever there when I turned on the light in the morning? Okay. I'll skip to 17. Haniglu lecha share mavit veshare sal mavit tireh. You know, God, Iyob, you will have a death wish. But what do you know about death even? Have the gates of death been revealed to you? Have you seen Share Salmavit? We saw that word that Iyob says. Hitbonant al racha be'aretz heged im yadata chulaha. Have you seen to the end of the earth? Do you know where the end is? Let me know if you know all that. Where is the place of light and darkness that you're commanding and you want all this to happen? You have no idea about any of this. Okay, it goes on for a bit. I didn't even bring the whole thing, but you can scan the rest of it and see these ideas going forward. And so now here's our question. What is the meaning of God's response here, right? It certainly looks like he's saying, what do you know? You're talking to me. I'm God. You're nobody. I'm stronger than you, right? And so Yov doesn't know anything at all. Okay, well, and does look like, just like Yov said, God, if you appear, you're just going to bully me. And so that's what he does. He just bullies him. But I think there is more. And some say, you know, the response is not so much in the content. The response is the fact that God revealed himself at all, right? And Yov does feel better afterwards. And some say, well, just knowing that God is there, even if he's not explaining why he does this and what he's all about, just saying, who are you to even ask? But God appeared and answered the question. I don't know if you were, protesting the president's policy on something, whatever. And then he came to your house, right? And said, listen, it's very complicated. Well, maybe you'd feel better. Maybe just, he came to my house.
He's giving you validation.
Right. I said, I can't explain it to you. You don't know anything, right? But he cared enough to write a letter back. So, and he spoke with them. Okay, good. All right, so anyway, that at least might be part of the response. Just knowing that God is out there and listening and has a connection is something, is a first step. But I think there's more. And as we saw, what's the difference between Iyov's perspective and God's perspective about these very things? Because we see that their speeches are connected. God is responding to Iyov. Well, I think Iyov's, yeah?
There are so many more dimensions to what God's handling, so much beyond the mind-brain capacity of the human creation.
Okay, right, and that's certainly part of it. There's more to... So I think one of Iyov's shortcomings, not sins that he deserved all this, right, but something that he had to grow into, is his self-centeredness. Iyov is saying, because these terrible things happened to me, my family, they are terrible things that happened to him, therefore the whole world should become darkness. The whole universe should cease to exist. Well, how about, are you going to ask anybody else? What about the guy down the block who's having a happy life? He doesn't want to give everything up because you did, right? And I guess this is, you know, if you're stuck in traffic on your lane, are you happier that the other lane is also stuck in traffic, right? Well, at least they're also, right?
German expression.
Or do you say, oh, at least they're getting to where they go. And so, right, to wish traffic upon all people ever driving because you're stuck in traffic, I mean, that's a little self-centered and small-minded, although understandable. I remember eight years ago when my sister passed away, the next day, before the burial, I walked out of my house and I saw that the newspaper had been delivered. And I remember feeling very upset that they printed the newspaper today and that they delivered it today and that the world goes on, right, after this happened. And so I think it's a very understandable for someone going through tragedy to center everything in on that momentous thing that's in front of them. And so we can understand Iyov, but God says, you know, this is not the only question. Okay, so I think now we have a second step here, right? Number one is that God even appeared at all and has some relation. And two, that you have to step back and look at the bigger picture, because what you're asking for is going to affect the whole universe, and some things that you can't understand. Okay, I think there's something even further in this speech itself, which is that it's all about day and night contrasting light and darkness. And I think part of the answer might be embedded here, which is that God is saying to Yov, look out and look at the natural order of the world. And you see how things follow a pattern. There are rules, laws that we've talked about before. The laws of physics. Everything follows these laws. Why do they do that? Why don't they change from day to day? Mm-hmm. Or right? They seem to change, but we're making better discoveries. I don't think they're really changing day to day. But right, everything follows pattern, and these laws are able to bring about great beauty in the world, and life, and all kinds of different species, anything, all kinds of things you can imagine. And so there is natural order in the world. Okay, we have to agree to that. And so therefore, God is telling you, oh, there's such great natural order, right? And God said, I created, I put that here into place. That's here for you. You didn't make that. Then, doesn't it logically conclude that there may be also a moral order in the universe, right? Natural order leads to the idea of there should be moral order also. And so God is saying, right, I have this taken care of. I created the world a good place after all, right? And just like you can't understand all the details of creation, of nature, you're not going to be able to understand everything about morality either. But even though, so again, I don't want to just stop at you don't know, right? Is there some hint? Is there something that we can know? So push a little further. Well, you know, in natural order, there is day and night, and light and dark, and old Genesis 1 is all about the contrast between the two, and land and sea, land representing civilization, and sea representing the forces of chaos that are constantly trying to come and bring them forth. And I think what you see there is that that good and evil have to be, or exist and have to be handled, right? And the way you can't have just light without darkness, you can't have land without the sea, right? You can't have life without death, so you can't have joy without suffering. So these contrasts are built in, right? In a yin-yang, you cannot possibly have one without the other. I don't know, could God create a universe where you can have everybody wins gold medals all the time, right? I don't know, I can't conceive of that, right? But I think we can understand within the current realms of existence that a gold medal is only worth something if there was a possibility that you lost, right? And that you really had to work for it. Everybody else is working for it. Then it's valuable, because it didn't have to be that way. And so that contrast, I think, so it's not explicit in this chapter, but I think it is implicit, and I think it is part of the lessons that are there. And so What I'm saying here was in part said by Martin Buber, who I mentioned before. He said that Kafka is the most important commentary. Let's skip to number 5. And read a little bit of it. Buber writes, "There is no doubt that the speech is intended for more than mere demonstration of the mysterious character of God's rule in nature to a greater and more comprehensive extent than had already been done by the friends and Job himself." Right? The friend said that. "Creation of the world is justice, not a recompensing and compensating justice, but a distributing, a giving justice." Right? The fact that God creates the world is already a gift, not in place of something else. "God, the Creator, bestows upon each what belongs to Him, upon each thing and being, insofar as He allows it to become entirely itself." That is a great gift, to give any individual, you know, be it a tree or a human, its identity, its boundaries, that make it something that's separate and from something else, and therefore gives it its own life. "Not only for the sea, but for everything, God breaks in the hour of creation His boundary, that is to say, He cuts the dimension of this or that thing out of the all, giving it its fixed measure, the limits appropriate to this gift." And I think here we see part of the idea of having free will. And so much evil in the world is as a result of God allowing human beings to make choices, and therefore to be able to make bad choices. Ladat tovara is built into the very story of Genesis. And this is a gift. The creation itself already means communication between creator and creature. The fact that we exist, that the world exists, is already communication. It means there is a relationship. That's God speaking in the whirlwind. "The just creator gives to all his creatures his boundary, so that each may become fully itself. Designedly, man is lacking in this presentation of heaven and earth, in which man is shown the justice that is greater than his, and is shown that he, with his justice, which intends to give to everyone what is due to him, is called only to emulate the divine justice, which gives to everyone what he is. In face of such divine teaching as this, it would be indeed impossible for the sufferer to do aught else than to put his hand to his mouth and confess that he had erred in speaking of things inconceivable to him." Right? So the lesson that to Iyov is not just that you don't see the whole picture, but as a result of understanding this idea of divine justice and gift-giving in creation, and you, Job, are created as part of that, and so you have an obligation to emulate God in bringing that forth further. Okay, I'll get back to that idea in a bit. Okay, but now let's go back to page 3. Right? So I think Buber is very important because he's saying, unlike what many have said before him, God's just bullying him and saying, "You don't know. You don't know anything. Right? Be quiet." No, so there's something more. There's something deeper here. Okay. Now, Yov's immediate reaction is bottom of page 3, chapter 40. So, Vayan Adonai et Yov, God says again, Harovim Shaddai Yisod Mochiach Eloah Ya'anena. Right? Who are you? Can you reprove the Almighty? Can one who argues with God answer him? God is saying, you know, give me an answer. What do you say? Vayan Yov et Adonai ve'omar, Hen Kaloti. I am small. I am light. Ma Ashiveka, what can I say to you? Yadi samta lemofi, I will put my hand on my mouth, I'll be quiet from now on. Hachati barti velo ene, ushtayim velo asif. I spoke once, but that's it. I'm not going to say anything again. Okay, so this is quite extraordinary, because this is after 40 chapters of nonstop, right? Poetry and speaking. And God comes out and says, okay, fine, I'll be quiet. Yeah. Well, we have to wonder. I mean, this is that's it. This is all Yov has to say. I don't know. It's like this a bully comes and he's making all kinds of noise, and you just say, "Please stop." He's okay, fine. You know, after like days and days of right, what's going on? How come Yov gives up so easily? Right? Is he so convinced by this argument? We saw that had. it's hard to even pick out any content in it. He doesn't actually respond to any of Iyov's specific questions. Yes, Hashem.
Recompensating justice. This was the whole mistake. The friends always thought it was tit for tat the whole time, quid pro quo. And God said they were wrong, and Iyov was right. In that he was right, but he contradicted them and said, no, it's not that way. Mm-hmm. And this is, of course, the secret of Iyov, that he revealed that's not how it works. And that's why he overthrew the whole wisdom, as you said. And here, it becomes so clear. So the message is enormously powerful, and when Iyov realizes that, I see, so I started off on the wrong foot. I started off with the assumption that it was quid pro quo, and all I could say was that I wasn't so bad, but I still shared their assumptions.
Right. So Iyov is quiet because God says, you're right.
You're right insofar as you understood.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a little bit out of order, because God didn't yet say, you're right. I mean, if you look ahead, let me just point down to everybody else. If you look on page 4, this is 42, verse 7. It says, after these things, God spoke these words unto Iyov, and God said to Eliphaz, my wrath is against thee, and against your two friends, because you have not spoken of me the thing that is right, as my servant Iyov has. Right? And so, I mean, this is quite amazing that God says, after all this, God does make a judgment. Iyov is right, the friends are wrong. What does that mean? That means that the whole ancient wisdom that most people have taught for centuries and centuries is that there is exact correspondence between justice and punishment, and Iyov rejects that, and he stands up for it, and God says, Iyov, you're right. But this is too late. Iyov, even a chapter before, already says, okay, I'll be quiet.
Well, I think that you pointed out the main tension was not between God and Job, between God and the theologians, the three friends, who think they have it all figured out.
Right.
So, and God says this quite explicitly, but before God, Job had only heard of God. He hadn't seen God. He knew that God was all-powerful, but he didn't understand the majesty of God. Now that he's come into contact with God, and he recognizes this is not only the all-powerful being, but something that can't even be described in logical terms. Uh-huh. The majesty of God silences him completely. He has nothing more to say.
Okay, good. So let's explore a kind of radical reading. Yes, Len.
Another thought about this is, you know, if you're having an argument with someone and they overpower you, you might outwardly comply and say, okay, mm-hmm. have it your way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas inwardly, you haven't really
good.
Complied. You're good. Still defiant. Inwardly.
Excellent. Okay, excellent. I mean, and we'll see, you know, there's a few more responses. One second. I want to read the response of Elie Wiesel. Because I think he goes along this line. It's a very radical reading of Sefer Iyov, because according to him, Iyov doesn't or shouldn't have given in. And Elie Wiesel is actually upset at Iyov for even outwardly saying, okay, you know, fine, I won't speak anymore. Right? Iyov, you let us down. Elie Wiesel is kind of as our modern-day Iyov. Right? He suffered. And spoke about it, and wrestled with God about it. So here's Elie Wiesel's a couple of quotes, page 5. God spoke to Job of everything except that which concerned him, and yet instead of becoming indignant, Job declared himself satisfied. As for nothing more, as far as he was concerned, justice had been done. No sooner had God spoken than Job repented. And so there was Job, our hero, our standard bearer, a broken, defeated man on his knees, having surrendered unconditionally. I mean, it's almost worse than that. If you read to the end, and Job gets double the wealth that he had before, right? Well, did God just buy him off? Right? This is, you know, a dictator, and you know, you have someone at the head of the opposition, and he's making a revolution, and then they come and say, listen, we'll give you $10 million and just be quiet. Okay, fine. Well, what do you say about that guy, right? Now he's complicit. And so this is Elie Wiesel's charge against Iyov. I think this reflects his own experience, and because it is Tisha B'Av, it's appropriate. Let's read one paragraph from Night. And what a great title, right? Night. Just like Iyov sees the whole world turning into night, so too Wiesel actually experienced it. I mean, in a way, the Holocaust is worse than anything ever Job ever went through, because not only did people lose all their wealth and all their family, but entire communities are gone forever. Never shall I forget that night, he writes. The first night in camp, which has turned my life into one long night, seven times cursed and seven times sealed. You see, he's reading Iyov as he's writing this. Never shall I forget that smoke. Never shall I forget the little faces of the children whose bodies I saw turned into wreaths of smoke beneath the silent blue sky. So he's cursing the blue sky like Iyov again. Never shall I forget those flames which consumed my faith forever. Never shall I forget the nocturnal silence which deprived me for all eternity of the desire to live. Never shall I forget those moments which murdered my God and my soul and turned my dreams to dust. Never shall I forget these things, even if I'm condemned to live as long as God himself. Never. Right, condemned to live. So you hear that kind of wishing to die rather than have to experience that. And Elie Wiesel's approach, a relationship to God, in very much parallels that of Iyov. Because he doesn't deny God because of this. He writes for an interview, for a Jew to believe in God is good, to protest against God is still good, but simply to ignore God, that is not good. Anger, yes. Protest, yes. Affirmation, yes. Indifference, no. You can be a Jew with God, you can be a Jew against God, but not without God. And that's Iyov. And Iyov never denies that God is there. That's precisely his source of frustration. God, I know you are there, right? But, and I know, I believe you're good. I believe you could do something about it. And that's the basis of my protest. And so Iyov wants, Elie Wiesel continues to protest, and he says, whoever put that ending, that he got all his money back and everything was okay and fine, this is not a good ending, right? This is just, I don't know, to pacify someone, right? But the real ending, what Iyov should have done, is continue to protest.
Two times in the Koda, in the end, we have the almost exact word, Ezor nach Gebetheim.
Yeah. Let's read that together. So Dr. Sham is pointing us to page 4 on top. And here God comes to Iyov again, Min HaSe'ara, and says, "Ezor na kehebel chalasecha shalecha vehodiyani ha'af tafer mishpati tarshiyani leman titztak." He says, "Gird your loins like a man. Now be a man again. Come on, you know, just don't sit there and complain and accuse me of any of these things, right? Will you even make void my judgment?" God says, "Will you condemn me so that you can be justified?" Do you have an arm? Can you lift weights like me? Can you scream like I do? Let's see you wear majesty and glory and beauty like God does as king. And let's say you cast abroad the rage of my wrath and look upon who he that is proud and bring him down. Take those wicked people and bring them down, give them what they deserve, and hide them down in the dust forever. If you can do that, then I will tell you, Chazak Baruch Job, right? You did a good job. So you can read this two ways. One is sarcastically, and saying, "Job, you want to say I'm a man, the man of, right? What are you? I'm the one," God says, "that is constantly all day long taking care of justice, taking care of God as a Superman, going from place to place, bringing justice to all the world. God is saying, you think this is easy? It's not a hard job. It's a hard job, right? There's a lot of evil people around there, right? Can you do what I do for good? I don't know. I mean, sometimes, you know, if you're you're frustrated at a government organization, whatever, you go to the head, you know, how come you're not doing anything about this, principal of your school? And he said, I'm taking care of these 100 things. Look at all these the problems I had to deal with just today. This is an important problem too. Okay, I'll try, right? And so so it might be sarcastic, like, what, can you help me? You can't help me. Or another way you could read it is, Yob, can you help me? Right? In other words, instead of coming and attacking me, why I don't do this, why don't you put your belt on and come on, join me as a partner in fighting the forces of evil in the world.
This is also in 38:3, we have the same exact words. About 30 years ago, your father-in-law told me the view of Rabbi Sassoon's father, which I then saw in one of his manuscripts, that if we take it that Jeremiah wrote this, that Yirmiyahu wrote this, and Yirmiyahu in the first chapter is told you will get up and you will fight for good and justice and so on and so forth, and we see in the beginning, the first chapter, second chapter, that Yirmiyahu was such a nice guy, he would bring a sacrifice in case his kids did something wrong. Well, get up and fight. Do something. Right. This is what God's telling us.
Good, good. So we see a flaw in Eeyore back in chapter 1. He's an excellent person, but only works defense, right? He's just afraid, maybe my children sin, I'll bring a preemptive sacrifice in case they did. He's Yare Elohim. He's fearful of punishment, but he's not proactive. He's not called a tzaddik. He doesn't go out and make sure that his community's needs are taken care of, and this is what he has to learn here. Rafe.
According to either of those two readings, how would you read the last pasuk? The one that he says, "Then I will confess unto thee that thy own right hand can save thee."
Yeah.
According to the sarcastic reading, how is he giving Job the power to?
If you can do that, I will shake your hand and say, "Good job, well done."
Sounds more serious than it does sarcastic.
Okay, it just depends how you twist it.
I think that's pretty good.
Is that the reading to imply that someone who's not a hero and not a subject, and not a common person, just an ordinary person who doesn't do anything wrong, but isn't so great, that they deserve to get things?
Do they deserve to get?
Do they deserve to get wrong?
Okay, good. So, no, they don't deserve it. Right? But I'll ask you, someone who's texting while they're driving, do they deserve to fall off the cliff?
That's doing something.
Yeah, before they hit someone else.
If they're drunk driving, then they should get a ticket.
Right. So I'm saying, we wouldn't say that person deserves it, right? If the cops stopped them, he wouldn't take him and throw him off the cliff, right? Give him a ticket, give him a warning. So it's not that it's deserving. But we know that the only way for evil to triumph is for good people to do nothing. So it's not that's deserved, it's just the result.
It's sort of inevitable and built into the universe because it's
that's
not
right.
possible for everyone to be great. Eeyore was even better than average.
I don't know. Okay, Stella.
Is there divine justice?
What?
Is there divine justice?
Is there divine justice? Okay. That's your question? Well, maybe you can help answer, because I'm not going to answer it in front of you. Okay. Yes?
Another perspective in terms of polishing these films is that everyone is having, even on his own, having this conversation, and Eeyore's having this conversation in his life as though he's done with his life. Right? He's holding Hashem on trial, and Liesel is speaking as though things are over. But it's not over. While you're still here, it hasn't ended yet. So Hashem is not going to come in to Eeyore, and as though Eeyore is now finished with his life, and as though things are complete, it's almost like he's still in the process. It's premature, this discussion that they're having, because this whole thing that they're discussing is still part of the process of his life.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So what Hashem is even doing is even sort of helping him through this process as he's still being
Yes, okay. This is very, very interesting. He's saying Yoav is still in the middle of it. Elie Wiesel and Stella Levy, the Holocaust is over.
Well, the Jewish people is not over. And
okay, wait, one sec. So, however, the pain is still there. The loss is still continues. All those family members and cousins that would have been are not. Furthermore, my wife spoke this morning, and she talked about how Elie Wiesel always would talk about the little boy that is him and his responsibility to that little boy to go and make sure to retell the story, otherwise we're accomplices to the story. So that little boy is in it. And he, on the one hand, is distant from the little because he's talking to him, but he's also the same person. So I think even though he grows up and he's out of it, in his mind, he's always that boy that's suffering and watching his father die, and he's always responsible for that for that person.
He said other things at the end of his life that he didn't say when he was dying, because he was still in the process.
Mm-hmm. Yes, good. I'd like to go on a little bit, and I'll make some more time for questions and comments. Which are all excellent. Okay, let's go to chapter 42 and see the rest of the ending. There's multiple levels of this ending. And so after God says, let's see if you could do a better job, and I would tell you, Chazak Baruch, Yov says, Yadati ki lo kichotucha lo basim mimecha mezima, I know that you can do everything, and so on, and he'll skip to 6. Chapter 42. Okay. Right. That's verse 5. Beforehand, I had only heard you, but now I see you. So Yov feels like he has a new revelation, a new understanding that he didn't have before. And he says, therefore, emas v'nichamti alafar ve'efer. I recant my words. I repent because I am only dust and ashes. And so this is much more than just saying, okay, I'll be quiet from now on. Right? So what is it? What is it that he realizes? We'll look at two more. Let's just see the end of the story is God says, the friends are wrong, and Eyov is right, and says, therefore, take 7 bulls and 7 rams, I'm skipping to verse 8, and go to Eyov and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, and my servant Yov shall pray for you, for him will I accept, and I do not unto you aught unseemly. Right? Let Yov pray for you, friends, and then I will punish you for all the horrible things you've said to him. And so the three friends go and do exactly that, and Yov prays for them. Vayisa Adonai p'nei Yov, God answers the prayers. And then, Badunai Shavet Shivut Yov et Pelelo Badrehu, Vayosef Adonai Kol Asher LeYov LeMishneh, and God gives him double everything he had and gives him long life. Okay, so that's the end. So what is the realization? What does Yov now understand that he didn't before? Here's one possible reading. Rabbi Harold Kushner wrote a very influential book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People. He himself had a son with a genetic disease. He watched his son grow old within just a few years and die. And so here's his take on it. He says, the problem of evil is based on 3 assumptions. That God is all-powerful and causes everything that happens in the world. Nothing happens without God willing it. That God is, too, that God is just and fair. And 3, that Job is a good person. And now Job's friends say, no, Job, you weren't a good person. And therefore, they can say, God is all-powerful and just and fair. Job, so God said, that's wrong. And that's one of the most important revelations of the book of Eyob. Job's solution is to reject B. He said, God, you are unfair, right? Or at least temporarily unfair, so come out, you know, and take a stand. So that's Job's opinion or charge The affirmation of God's good, Job's solution is to reject proposition B, affirmation of God's goodness. Job is in fact a good man, but God is so powerful that he is not limited by consideration of fairness and justice. Let me suggest, this is Kushner says, that the author of the book of Job takes a position which neither Job nor his friends take. He believes that in God's goodness and Job's goodness, and is prepared to give up his belief in proposition A, that God is all powerful. Well, Stella, what do you want to say?
I agree with
Kushner. Okay, good. So we have our answer. So what does that mean for God? Then what sense is he God if he's not all powerful, right? What does that even mean? For those of you who are here for Maimonides, we saw Maimonides goes into this in a lot of depth and says, when you say all-powerful in a human sense, not the same as saying it in God's sense. When you say strong for a human, it's not a different word. It's the same word, but a different definition. And you have to understand God's nature of God and how he interacts with the universe, and that there is general providence over all species and the laws of nature which are good and keep everything going, right? But individual is God telling every blade of grass to grow? Maimonides does not think so. And so Kushner can say God is all-powerful in some sense, but not in the sense that he's going to stop the bullet that's going and going to kill an innocent person. Right? There is within the world. There is God grants that free will. God grants the possibility of evil in order for there to be good. Right? For whatever reason, God does not or cannot intervene. And this is an important change in mindset, because if God is God of justice and not of power, then he can still be on our side when bad things happen to us. He can know that we are good and honest people who deserve better. Our misfortunes are none of his doing, and so we can turn to him for help. We will turn to God not to be judged or forgiven, but to be strengthened and comforted. And this is, you know, like we say, Imo Anochi Betzara. God says, I am with you in your troubles. And we say, where was God when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed? Where was God in the pogroms? Where was God in the Holocaust? He was with us in exile. He was with us in the death camps. And so, rather than turning to God in judgment or in judging us, God is with us and a source of comfort. Yeah?
Isn't the problem that Judaism is an interventionist religion? I mean, they said, I took you out of Egypt.
Uh-huh.
So now you can speak of a secular world. They said, no, God is a helpless bystander. It goes against the grain of Judaism.
It's joyous.
Okay, so helpless bystanders, I think, a little too extreme. There's a time and place, and eventually, have faith, have trust, right? And this is Tehillim, is all that. It says, God, I know you're good. I know you care about us. Why are you hiding your face? You know, why is it taking so long? But it will, right? It will. It's a message of hope.
I'm sorry, I don't know Hebrew, and I just know what I know from Scripture from most of the King James translations. But I recall a line there from Job that is so incredibly precious, and I didn't hear it. And that is, I am made from the Spirit of God, and the very breath of God gives me life. So he's not just dust and ashes, and he's not the wholeness of God's power and consciousness, but he's got a piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of pieces, that is a big collection of humanity.
Good.
If it would bring forth that aspect of their beings, you've got a powerful.
Okay, very nice.
Window.
So I need to conclude in just a couple of minutes.
Is that true? Is that the line?
I don't know the King James by heart.
No,
I don't know.
I meant the Hebrew. Yeah. Never heard of
I have to check. I'm not sure. Okay. To bring it together, I think we see a lot of lessons here, and the final words. So this is something very interesting. Somebody wrote an article showing that in the history of Jewish exegesis, you'll see that most people going from Second Temple times to Chazal to Rishonim find something wrong that Eov did, right? That's how they solve it. Eov must have done something wrong. That's true till the Holocaust. For Jewish writers, most, from the Holocaust on, that no longer is an option, right? And now they, and I think actually it's the true meaning of the book, because I think by saying Yoav does something wrong after God said it, Yoav is right, right? Is a harmonizing reading of the book. And so if it's not Yoav, then we'll have to say something like Buber or Wiesel or Kushner, right? Rejecting or thinking about, rethinking those other two. And we'll end with Rabbi Soloveitchik, who says, man's task in the world is to transform fate into destiny, right? Fate is the things that happen to us, right? So we just go along, well, this is what happened. Destiny means we are going to act, take charge. A passive existence into an active existence, one of compulsion, perplexity, mutinous, into existence replete with a powerful will, resourcefulness, daring, and imagination. Skipping a line, how shall a person act in a time of trouble? What ought a man to do that he not perish in his afflictions? The halachic answer to this question is very simple. Afflictions come to elevate a person, to purify, sanctify his spirit, to cleanse and purge of his dross of superficiality, vulgarity, to refine his soul, to broaden his horizons. The halacha teaches us that the sufferer commits a grave crime if he allows his trouble to go to waste and remain without meaning or purpose. What a beautiful line. So it's not to say, why did this happen? But rather to say, what can I learn from it? Now what can I do? Right? What meaning can I bring from it? And if we look at the very last line, when does God restore to Iyov all that he had before? Only after Iyov prays for his friends. Right? Only after he gets out of his self-enclosed bubble and selfishness and say, whatever suffering I have, I don't wish it upon anyone else. I wish them the best. All right, and then now he's able to be redeemed. And as we said back in the first lecture, Iyov's redemption, he's not just one particular person. We don't even know if he existed or not. But the point is, he is every person, and he furthermore represents especially the Jewish people. Because restoring 10 children after losing 10 children doesn't really make up for it. But on a national level, when we've lost so much, but then have come back and able to regain our independence and so much blessing, this is the restoration that the book of Iyov is talking about. And so we are on our way to becoming restored, to seeing Zion not desolate anymore. But we continue to think about Iyov and to think about all those lessons that we have learned in the past from all that suffering, and what that means, what can we do about it? We have to put on our own belts and go and continue to fight evil. Oh, I know, I want to read one sentence. This is the New York Times Magazine. Some of you saw it. There's no ads, only one article in it from this past weekend, all about what's going on in the Middle East. And all the way at the end, I'm sure you've gotten to the end, right? I skipped to the end of one. And he writes, on a more philosophical level, this journey, he's talking about, you know, the Arab Spring and ISIS, and this journey has served to remind me again of how terribly delicate is the fabric of civilization, of the vigilance required to protect it, and of the slow and painstaking work of mending it once it has been torn. This is hardly an original thought. It is a lesson we were supposed to have learned after Nazi Germany, after Bosnia and Rwanda. Perhaps it is a lesson we need to constantly relearn. I think this is the lesson of Tisha B'Av. And so as we move from sorrow to celebration, I hope that we will see in the continuing nechama of Sion, in the continuing and a comfort of Zion. May we all merit to see the comfort of Zion. Thank you.
I will begin momentarily on page 78 of the Fast Day books. If I could ask everyone to
thank you.